back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. Hopefully the next time we're getting together, we're going to positively be having a crab cake at Fadley's, and we do invite everyone down there, and our guest is already mouthwatering. That's what we do on the program here. We sell crab cakes, and then we talk about making the state better, and we're going to be over at State Fair. We're doing a crab cake tour that's going to be inspired here this summer by my cousin who grew up here. It's a long story. Go listen to Max Weiss out in the podcast, Audio Vault, if you want to check that out. But we are shipping crab cakes, talking True Blue as well. And I think this guest will want to, he's probably had a few crab cakes. It was going to be the, you know, he's a political leader, an aspiring governor, all that stuff. Lived in Annapolis for a little while. Was on MSNBC. But like when you start talking crab cakes, you melt people here. Right, Don? You know that, right?
Absolutely. And my guess is the lieutenant governor's had a crab cake or two along the way.
Oh, yeah, baby. You know that's right.
Do they have crab cakes in Upper Marlboro? Because, listen, I'm from Dundalk. He's from Catonsville, all right?
Oh, I know.
Michael Steele is our guest, right? So, you know, I always thought of it as being like a real Baltimore thing or an Ocean City thing. But I didn't realize, and I started talking to people, the Washington suburbs are the ones who buy the Gucci crab meat that come from Maryland in July and August, September. You know, a little bit more high-end product or whatever that – I never thought, like, let's go down to D.C. and get crabs. You know, like, never did I think that in my life. No,
you don't necessarily go to D.C. to eat crabs. I'll be very honest with you, and this is seriously no lie. I typically, 9 times out of 10, certainly outside of the metro area, I don't. It's 100%. I do not eat crab outside of Maryland. The state
absolutely.
Of Maryland.
Well, that's rule number
one. I just don't. I've traveled everywhere, and you know, people crack. I'm like, dude, no, unless this came from the Chesapeake Bay.
and Lieutenant Governor, don't they always? We laugh about every guest is the same. Don't they all? I said, my sister got me once, and that was it. It was the P.T. Barnum thing. She got me one, but don't they always do this to you? I know you don't believe it's going to be as good as Maryland, but this place really.
Right?
If you listen to me, if you're somewhere else and it says Maryland style, right. BS.
Done. If it says Maryland style, you actually get up and leave the restaurant.
All right. So listen, Mike, I'm going to be doing a tour, and I make crab. You know, Nixon, and I see Lincoln behind you. Nixon was also in that party. He had ping pong democracy. I'm going to do crab cake democracy. So what we're going to do is I figure this is a way to get the Trump people with the Steele people with the Democrat. We can get people together over a crab cake east of the Chesapeake Bay, west, wherever we want to do it. So here's what it is. And I figure we can just argue broiled and fried, you know, any way you want, pimento or not, too much celery seed, J.O. Old Spice. If a celebrity really comes, I mean, a big time celebrity, you know, flies in and you're taking them somewhere and you want to show off and you want you're taking for a crab cake, I want to know, is it broad fried? Where are you taking them? One time, one shot. Because I'm asking everyone because I'm trying to amass a list.
Jerry Seafood.
What'd I tell you, Nestor?
And I get them the crab bomb and their life is changed.
I've never been there. See, this is why I want to do this. I'm trying to find new things.
Nestor, here's the deal.
All right.
Let's do this. Let's do it. You're my guest at Jerry Seafood. You and Don, you are familiar, so you are welcome, my friend. Well, you appreciate it.
You know, I'm a Democrat, right? You know that, right? You know.
All the more reason to invite you. All the more reason to invite you, Nestor, because I got to work on you. And as they say, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. So here we go.
Where did my good buddy, Wayne Curry, always take me?
There you go. He took you to Jerry Seafood.
If you're going to eat crab all the time,
if you're going to have and look, this is not to put down any because there's some good crab joints in Prince George's County. But if you just want to have that crab cake experience, which for someone like myself is the quintessential Maryland crab cake experience, you need to sit there with the crab bomb in front of you, which literally is about the size of my fist. And you have that, and you just walk out of there a changed individual. So, Nestor, this is you and me, babe. My invitation, when it works for you, You are welcome. I will make it happen.
I usually don't make a thing about hanging around Redskins fans or Washington football team fans right now. You know,
that's okay. That's okay. Look. I was.
You're my state too. I see the flag behind you. I feel like you're one. You know, I mean.
Look, I love Baltimore. And look, I need the Ravens to get it right with their quarterback to give him what he needs so he can do his thing. There I look go. Forward to it in the future. A Washington football team Ravens Super Bowl. So this is all we're there.
All right,
I can tag along. You said I'm allowed to come and tag along and sit at another table.
Absolutely.
No, we're going to make fun. So Lieutenant Governor Michael Steele is here. MSNBC, you know the whole deal. My hair is getting longer here during the pandemic. It'll be even longer. We get that crab cake. I don't have that issue.
I did not have that issue during the pandemic, but okay.
We're 2 years into Baltimore Positive, right? Now, my 30th year doing sports radio, and a couple years ago when Don and I, he was running Baltimore County, we got together, we put a list together, and I said, we're going to do this. I want it to be awesome, professional. I want to have a cool logo. We got a crab in the logo. We've had this run, but literally you're one person. When I started making the list of people I talked to, whether it was celebrities or musicians or whatever, politicians, I called you, and I'm not doing any butt smooching here. I called you my favorite Republican, right? Because like you make sense when you speak to me. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be asking me to vote for you, or right. At least that's the rumor, you know, it might not be in a primary, but
He didn't ease into that, Lieutenant Governor.
No, he didn't.
No. I literally love having you on the show. I wish we had you more often. I'm looking forward to this crab.
No, we can. You're in rotation.
More than anything, after the last 4 years, right? I mean, and I watch you on TV, and you know, you have to defend the indefensible. I have people in my life that are still, you know, ready to climb the Capitol on January 6th. And it was stolen. And I said, are you teaching your children this? And then, you know, then there's you and where you are politically in all of this, and whether that ideology can ever work again here or anywhere else. Right. I think that's the great debate over the next couple of years, whether you run, whoever, somebody's going to run the state, somebody, you know,
right.
There is a debate about whether your party can ever bring it back in.
Right. It's a legitimate question. It's a real debate. It is one that is getting played out. Certainly, there's a lot more focus and energy around the national narrative, you know, with respect to the party leadership and the RNC and all of that. But where it really matters, and where I think it will see the greatest impact and effect, is at the grassroots level. Among base Republicans, which is admittedly, which a lot of folks don't like to admit, Nestor, is much broader than is portrayed in the press oftentimes.
Every day it's called the Trump Party now. That's
right.
Every day.
And that ultimately may be the fate of the Republican Party at the end of the day. We don't know. But I've spent a significant amount of time with a number of Republicans who are, you know, very strong conservatives, rock-ribbed Republicans, if you will, who are very much engaged and ready to take this fight to the street, if you will, to sort of pull the party back from the precipice on which it currently finds itself. And I think that's important. Fundamentally, remember, this party's history, its origins, was born out of the idea of freedom. Okay. It was born out of the idea that everyone who's on this soil is protected by the Constitution. That's why the nation went to war back in the 1860s. It's why the party led the fight to get the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments passed. Why it led the fight to advance the cause of the suffrage for women, you know, the right of women to vote, and why it engaged in the 50s and 60s with working with Democrats, quite honestly, who were of a like mind to bring about the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, to now turn our backs on that history. And that legacy, to me, is the one of the biggest offense. January 6th is the ultimate offense. To hear some in my party make excuses for what happened then, But for a lot of us, that's the level of engagement. And we want to have that discussion. We need to have that discussion. And I'll tell you, quite honestly, gentlemen, this goes back. This isn't just about Trump. And a lot of people truly misunderstand what how deep this runs. This goes back to 1989. This goes back to when Reagan stepped off the stage. The fight began over who would be the next Ronald Reagan, who was going to galvanize this base, create the coalitions like Reagan did to sort of move the party into the future. And there have been disruptions in that along the way. There have been skirmishes that have occurred, which we saw play out in 2006, where we hammered our own. I know I was on the ballot in 2006 and know what that was like, where I had to defend being a Republican to Republicans, which is crazy as hell. But then, of course, we see that play out again with the Tea Party during my time at the RNC. And then subsequent to that, the Freedom Caucus in the House of Representatives and ultimately Trump's election. So there you can see the battle lines haven't been drawn for quite some time. And it's a fight that needs to be engaged.
Well, I would say you said it post 89. I would say Rush Limbaugh won. You know, ideologically, over the last 30 years of me watching this play out, I supported you. I supported Bob Ehrlich.
Right.
Very, very publicly.
No, I know.
I voted for you. You know, I stumped for you, you know, big time.
Right.
So, you know, I have to just, I mean, the obvious question, I wrote this down because, I mean, I am here to try to ask some tough questions.
Sure.
What spoke to you as a black man over the last 20 years about the Republican Party to keep you engaged when as a Latin-ish guy from Dundalk that
right.
This Trump thing and the racial part of this is the part, the guns, I hear the money, the business side of it, I own a business. I mean, I hear taxes, I get all of that. But what has spoken to you over the last two decades to sort of keep you with an R next
to
your name?
That's a very fair question, and it's not tough to ask, and it's not tough to answer. But it is there are nuances to it. Look, I grew up in Washington D.C., and you really haven't experienced the joy of living until you've tried it as a black Roman Catholic conservative from Washington, D.C., right? And I had no real feet inside the Republican Party. I wasn't a young Republican. I wasn't a college Republican when I was at Johns Hopkins. And so I made a conscious decision based on how I was raised. And I was raised in a Democratic household. In fact, in my family, there was one Republican. My aunt Josephine was the only Republican in the family. No one talked to her. So
I had an aunt the same way. And if my father did Herbert Hoover, my father, you know, stood in soup lines in 1929.
Right.
So like in my house, that didn't fly.
Right.
You know?
So, you know, my parents were Roosevelt Democrats and still are to this day.
And then Kennedy's too.
And Kennedy. Yep. We had Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy and Jesus Christ on the wall growing up. Yeah, those images were on the wall. So
we had Brooks and Johnny, but it was East Side, you know.
Yeah, it's East Side. Right. Right. So we, you know, so you had this very, very dynamic space growing up, but it's insular. My mother, when I was 17 and I could vote that November, I would have turned 18 before the election in 1976. That October, I turned 18 and voted in November. So leading up to that, I talked to my mom about it, and she said to me, she said, "Well, don't be a Democrat because I'm a Democrat. You know, go out and figure it out for yourself. You know, be your own person." And I did. I went out and I learned about both parties. And what I came to understand was the anchor, the history, the home of the black community politically was in the Republican Party. That's our origin story, right? And you had individuals like Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and others who occupied that space at the time and helped shape that party in its nascent days. And remember pulling to the right right side of history, individuals like Abraham Lincoln. That people really don't appreciate the relationship between a Frederick Douglass and an Abraham Lincoln in moving Lincoln to the point where he could actually write the Emancipation Proclamation. Because remember, he was the guy who was like, nah, this don't offend anybody. We want to keep this neutral to preserve the Union. But he then took those bold steps. So that's that narrative for me was really compelling, that African-Americans had a role in shaping that. So irrespective of the recent history of the party at that time, coming off the horrible speech of Wallace, not Wallace, Goldwater in 1964, where he's talking about embracing segregation, and what Nixon did in 68 in embracing that further with his Southern strategy to win the disaffected white men who were turned off by Johnson's embrace of civil rights. That founding idea resonated with me, that this was the party that was, at the end of the day, was going to stand for the individual right and the individual freedoms and liberties. And I still believe that, which is why I stay in the fight. It's why I call myself a Lincoln Republican, because it's not the only person, the only thing I orient to is the idea of fighting for and providing for the freedom of under the Constitution for all citizens, and embracing that, which is why I'm not afraid of expanding the vote for every community. I'm not afraid of creating greater opportunities for political discourse in the country, as opposed to the narrowly defined ones that we have now structured through the two parties. I mean, I would get into big battles inside the RNC when I would talk about, hey, can we expand our primary process here and allow for more voices? When I was state party chairman, we opened up our primary in 2002. In 2000 for independents to vote in our primary.
I was going to ask you this.
We did that.
With the Georgia thing, I said to my wife, are there still really angry white people in Georgia who are not registered to vote? I mean, who are they trying to, who could you still recruit at this point? Because it feels like Trump really has pulled everyone in who wants a part of that, that growing the Republican Party right now would be probably more difficult. And the more you talk about your philosophy, I'm like, oh, that's what the Democrats believe in. So when you say that on MSNBC, I guess that's where it is, right?
Yeah, let me pick up on that, Nestor, because a couple of things as you speak, Mr. Lieutenant Governor. One, I think in the rearview mirror, sometimes your success at the RNC doesn't get talked about a lot. You really had begun to expand the tent, correct? And had some success. I mean, refresh our listeners' memories. I mean, this wasn't some wide-eyed dream you had. You actually began to bring it to fruition.
We did. We had incredible success. You know of them today. Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, Governor Sandoval, a number of other elected officials at the state level. We got two African-American judges elected for the first time to the bench in the state of Texas. So we had a growing national network of grassroots activists. My argument to them was, I don't live in your neighborhood, you do. So you're the best representative of the Republican Party in your community. It's something I share with the state chairman all the time. Get out of your damn comfort zone. Get off your ass and go knock the doors in the neighborhoods and listen to what people are telling you. You can't engage someone unless you're looking at them in the eye and hearing what they have to say. So
I heard your message 20 years ago, right? And a lot of people did. And a lot of those people are registered, have made Larry Hogan, two-term governor, right? I mean, in a state that was dripping Democratic forever.
Well, right? And to that point, you know, when I was state chairman, I had, put together a strategy, a grassroots strategy. And the proposal at that time, and it's a great irony of fate, I guess, was to win the governorship by 2010. That was the goal. I developed a 10-year strategy to win the governorship and to build up the opportunities in the state legislature and the Senate. And so then Bob Early picks me to be on the ticket. And so when you know, I was talking to Lewis Pope, who was then chairman of Howard County, and he wanted, and he got moved into as vice chair, sort of took over implementing that strategy. And we did. We pursued that strategy. And lo and behold, to your point, Nestor, we wound up convincing voters to take the risk on these two crazy Republicans running for governor and lieutenant governor. We picked up some House seats. We picked up Senate seats, so much so that it scared the bejesus out of Mike Miller that they changed the cloture rules in the Senate. Because we were literally two votes off of being able to sustain cloture. So they moved it from, I think it was at that time, 16 to 19. And it couldn't go any further because, they're, you know, 24 is the magic number you need in the Senate. So, you know, we did have an impact. And we, I thought, began the opportunity to present a case to Marylanders to take a critical look at the kind of Republicans who would come along to advance a governing idea for the state. And Bob Early did that very successfully and I think very effectively. And it's a shame he wasn't given another bite at the apple, you know, not to second guess or call regrets on what voters decided in 2006. But it is a shame that they didn't trust his leadership enough to give him a second term to further implement the path and the changes that we were looking in place. And instead, we got 8 years of raising taxes and all of that from O'Malley. And of course, by that point, the folks are like, oh, hell no, we ain't doing any more of this. And Hogan made the case to change Maryland. And so you're right. When you look at the success that we've been able to do, built off of this idea of having an informed conversation with Marylanders, in a state where we're outnumbered 2-1, and in jurisdictions like Prince George's, where we're outnumbered 8, 9, 10-1, in some cases, I think it's a big and important step forward. And it I think potentially bodes well for the future, but there's still some fighting and some reconciliation that has to go on because we have to now talk to a state and a country that has witnessed the last 4 years culminating in January 6th. And those who have voiced opinions that I think are antithetical to democracy inside my party, we don't own that, but we definitely have to make clear that's not who we are.
Well, it's why
voters that's the expectation for voters, I think.
It's what we love about it. We can have these honest discussions. Obviously, I would have a different reflection for another day, maybe over that crab cake of the success of the O'Malley years.
And yeah, you and well, I 48 tax increases in 8 years. I'm like, dude, seriously?
you and I will have that discussion another day. but what I do, I read a story today, Lieutenant Governor,
yeah,
and it really made me think about you. I don't know if you saw it. But I thought, man, that's really where we are. It was about Greenville, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
There's a woman in Greenville, South Carolina named Lena Smith. She's been a Republican Party activist for 30 years. Right. They claim she has one of the best Rolodexes of local precincts throughout the state of South Carolina of any Republican. She's an avid anti-abortion activist. None of her politics would line up with mine. She's
right,
way
right
to the right of me. But she's been a very, very effective party activist. She was just recently blindsided in a meeting when they went to reelect, you know, the party officials and the precinct captains in Greenville. A handful of people showed up at the meeting that she had never seen before. And they were Lynn Wood, MAGA folks, really not even ever been involved in South Carolina politics. And they voted out Lena Smith and anyone close to Lena Smith as not being conservative enough and not Trump-like enough, where now this MAGA group that has no roots in South Carolina, no connections to South Carolina, no Rolodex in South Carolina, is in charge of local politics in South Carolina. And how does that play out?
Oh, I said no. That goes to the point I was making initially about everyone's kind of focusing on what's happening up here at the top, where the action you need to pay attention to is at the grassroots. What you're watching is a systematic takeover and rollover of local party activists, long-term activists, long-term and long-time activists within the party, by those who are themselves either in many cases not Republicans, fake Republicans, or individuals who are playing the grift, meaning getting in to sort of figure out how they can either bolster their pocketbook or their profile with no connection or root to what's been happening in that jurisdiction at all. And this is just a good example of it. So the consequences are, the litmus test is, and I don't know in her particular case if she had said anything about Donald Trump or anything like that. But it really,
well, that is all it takes, right?
It's all it takes. Okay. But the point is, Nestor, it doesn't necessarily matter either, because it's the takeover of the apparatus to control for future opportunities and elections. So it doesn't matter whether or not she was a pro-Trump person or not a pro-Trump person. It's someone that they A, don't know, B, can't rely on. So she's got to go. Let's put in someone that we trust and we know who will rely on, take orders on what we tell them to do. And we've seen that happen across the country. This is not just in South Carolina, but it's happening across the country. And again, it begs the larger question of what does the Republican Party look and sound like in future elections? And how do you navigate that space if you are a Mitt Romney, Liz Cheney, Adam Kinzinger Republican? Versus a, you know, a
Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Yeah, a Marjorie Taylor Greene or you know, Boebert or whomever.
Mo Brooks.
Mo Brooks kind of Republican. And that's the battle line that's being drawn. You know, for me, I'm like, bring it, baby. Let's have that conversation.
Well, that's what I want to ask you. And I know your time is tight. Really appreciate it. My question for you is, make it local. I mean, it's no secret. You're thinking about what's next for Michael Steele. My question for you, let's make it even bigger than Michael Steele. You know Maryland Republicans about as well as anyone. Can Michael Steele and Barry Glassman, who's a good friend of the show, been on a number of times,
right,
and the Alan Kittlemans, can Michael Steele, Alan Kittleman, Barry Glassman Republicans still prevail in the Maryland Republican Party?
That remains to be seen. It's a hard question to answer. My instincts and my hope would be yes, because I think in each instance, outside of the hard asses, the people who just are hard headed about their blind loyalty for a man who is himself not a conservative nor a Republican. Remember, and I would say these to these folks, remember, Donald Trump changed his party affiliation 5 times leading up to settling on becoming a Republican 18 months before he announced for president. So,
well, you don't have to convince us of the grift.
Oh, I know.
You know what I mean?
Well, so I just think, Lieutenant Governor, because your time is tight, I want to jump in. People want to know, beyond the rumor, how will you make a decision whether to try this game again? What will go into it for you?
I'm in it now. I'm just looking at it. I talk to folks. I talk to everyday Marylanders.
Like us.
Like you. Absolutely. And in key corners of the state, and just kind of get a feel. Look, you know, I've never been a creature of the system. And I think that's kind of evident by how the system responds to me a lot of times. I believe very firmly in public service. It's oriented and rooted in my desire for service, and the fact that I spent time in a seminary, in a monastery, that part of me was rooted in that level of public service. And I remember asking God at one point in my prayer, how do you want me to serve your people? Do I do it in a religious habit or do I do it in a business suit? And, you know, here I am. And so that to me still matters. The best time I had and the closest I ever felt to people was when I was lieutenant governor, because I could see how you could make these unwieldy sort of wild institutions in government actually be of good service to people. And so that level of commitment and heart is there. But if folks don't want that, if they want just brash, you know, badass politics, angry, hateful politics, an unwillingness to work with the opposition and other, you know, I don't see anyone as an enemy unless they make themselves an enemy.
Well, what's your sense though, so, LG? I mean you talk to Maryland Republicans. What does your gut tell you about where they are? There's a gut there.
Yeah, I think they're still working it out. I think they're two camps. I mean, you've got folks who want to continue with sort of expanding and growing the party the way we saw under Ehrlich and Hogan, and then there are those who you know think that Maryland is much more conservative than it is. I keep reminding them it's a blue state for a reason. They're outnumbered 2-1. Democrats in this state tend to be a little bit more center right in some areas of the state. Certainly in the area where Nestor gets to hang out. And that's good. You've got to appreciate and account for that. So you can't paint with a broad brush that all Democrats in the state are you know, crazy left progressives, and all Republicans in the state are crazy right wing Trumpists, because that's not what Maryland is. Maryland is, in many respects, very much like our topography, diverse. We've got mountains and oceans. We've got, you know, beaches and farms. And so politically, we are oriented very much the same way. Yes, we've got the hard right and the hard left, but we've got a lot of common sense Democrats and Republicans, and that's not the mushy middle for the numbnuts out there. It is common sense, goal-oriented individuals who want good things for their communities, and they expect good things from their public servants. So the question is finding that spot and having that conversation, given the cacophony of noise from the hard edges of our politics, which I think the polling now, as both of you gentlemen know, and Don, you certainly know as a former official, you get it, right? Is trending more towards that common sense space, which is one of the reasons that things that helped Joe Biden. You look at the response to how he's approaching COVID. You look at the response to how he's approaching infrastructure. While people may disagree with the XL pipeline decision, or they may disagree with the slowness of the schools reopening, in the main, they like the steadiness and they like the focused discipline of a leadership and a style that they are getting feedback from.
I think you nail it with that, Lieutenant Governor. I was going to say, I don't know about you. I've been shocked that his poll numbers have remained constant. I mean,
I haven't been.
So you thought that yearning for normalcy was that strong?
I saw it in the 2020 cycle. And to the extent that I wasn't physically able to travel, I spent a hell of a lot of time on Zoom and really spent a lot of time talking with boards of elections, chiefs, secretaries of states, and particularly among my Republican cohort, sort of drilling down on what they were hearing and seeing on the ground. And the reality is, this did not surprise me. And it doesn't surprise me if he stays in that sort of in that sweet spot in the conversation. I've been on air saying this for the past 2 weeks now. He's going to present a real problem and a real challenge for Republicans. Do not fall into the mindset thinking that, because it's the midterm election and the first term of an incumbent president, that he's going to lose 26 seats because that's what his history says you kind of lose. I don't think that's the case. I think Joe Biden has the potential to hold the House and hold the Senate with the help of Americans. And trust me on this, not just Democrats. Democrats. So right. I think it's important to really appreciate and understand what our political landscape looks like, number one, but most especially, gentlemen, what the American people and what people in states like Maryland are saying about their expectations in the face of the challenges that we have. And they're looking for the men and women who can at least make a good faith effort to address and recognize those challenges.
So is your decision? This, go ahead. One quick one. Is your decision? I'll throw it back to Nestor. Is your decision affected at all by who the Democrats nominate, or is that irrelevant?
No, it's irrelevant.
Okay.
We get that crab cake together, Jerry's, right? That's what it can be.
Jerry's Seafood, baby.
Crab bomb. Is this fried or is it broiled?
It's broiled.
All right. I'm going to have it. However the chef makes it is how I'm going to eat it.
It's broiled and it is. Oh, Don, you've had it.
It's big time.
It's a whole
He's been telling me about it, really. I mean, he loved Wayne. So, you know, that's.
Yeah, I know. I know Wayne's. Oh, absolutely. Don't get me wrong. I mean, look. This is what I love about this state. When you get a crab cake on the Eastern Shore, well, that's kind of like manna from heaven, all right? Because that's the home ground right there. But whether it's the Eastern Shore, whether it's Dundalk up in the area where you are, down here in Montgomery, Prince George's County area, the central portions of the state and Howard. And so, man, wherever you go, you get a different style and a different vibe, but it's all Maryland crab cake. And that's what I love about it.
We're going to do it. Thank you. We held you overtime. We'll see you on MSNBC, all right?
You got it, my friends. Take care. I look forward to coming back.
I love having you on, man. Appreciate you.
And the Michael Steele podcast, right?
Yes. Check me out on the Michael Steele podcast. You know where to get your podcast and all that stuff. I'm there, and I appreciate the plug. And I'll see you guys on the other side of fun.
People tell me I don't have real Republicans on the show. I mean, come on. You know what I mean?
Well, some folks may say you still haven't had a real Republican on the show, but that's okay. That's okay. I laugh in their general direction, so it's all good.
Well, I like common sense, and I appreciate you. My favorite Republican, there he is, Michael Steele, joining us here. On behalf of Don Mohler and crab cakes everywhere, and our friends at Fadley's and our friends at State Fair and our friends at Wise Markets having intelligent conversations. We are WNST.net, AM 1570. Towson, Baltimore, we never stop talking. Baltimore, positive.